Welcome to the She Wore Black podcast. I'm Agatha Andrews. Today, I welcome back Hester Fox to discuss her gorgeous and riveting new book, The Book of Thorns. We discuss the transgressive language of flowers, France during the Napoleonic Wars, and even a few Pride and Prejudice moments for fans of Jane Austen. I have The Book of Thorns in my bookshop if you want to support both the podcast as well as independent bookstores nationwide. That's at bookshop.org/shop/sheworeblack. If you want another way to help out my show, you can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and leave me a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can also join my Patreon community, buy merch, or make a coffee donation through the links available on my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com. Thanks for joining me today. Now, on to the show. Well, Hester Fox, you have been coming on this show from its very beginning, and I am so excited to have you back because you get to talk to us about The Book of Thorns, and I could not put this book down. It is very exciting. Thank you for coming on the show to talk to me about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Agatha. If I've been with you from the beginning, I have just enjoyed watching also the progress of the podcast.
Aww.
And listening to it and just like the heights that it's reaching. So I'm so excited to still be a part of it. Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, I still like seeing your praises. Anytime I can work in a Hester Fox book into a conversation, I do it.
I appreciate it.
Of course. Well, you write such wonderful books, and I cannot tell you. I mean, I picked this up and I've been taking pictures. I've been underlining. I've been sending it to people. This book is so good, Hester. And look, I love all of your work, but I was just like picking people out of the room that I'm reading in. Like, I did not want to be interrupted. It's so good. I cannot wait for everybody to read this book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yes. Well, why don't you give our listeners an insight into what it's all about?
Okay, so the Book of Thorns, it takes place in what's known as Napoleon's Hundred Days. So this is after Napoleon escapes from Elba, kind of like the tail end of the Napoleonic Wars, which culminate in the Battle of Waterloo. So it's a very interesting little window of history with a lot going on in Europe, kind of a sweeping landscape, if you will. And against this landscape is the story of two sisters that were separated at birth. And one is kind of living as the niece of minor country gentry in England, in the English countryside, and the other is essentially an indentured servant in Brussels in Belgium. And they have no idea of each other's existence, but they both have unique gifts with flowers. So the flowers kind of speak to them in different ways. There's a magical element that one of the sisters is aware of already. And as events unfold with Napoleon, landing back in France and making his march across there to Brussels, the sisters cross paths for the first time and they learn of each other's existence, and a lot happens there. I don't want to give too much away.
Exactly.
But for us from there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is a slight departure from your more traditional Gothic novels, which you told me that was going to be the case when we last talked. And I know that we spoke about this at the end of our last episode together, but would you mind telling us again how you arrived at a story that takes place in France during the Napoleonic Wars versus your usual settings of either England or New England?
So after my first four books, which are my New England books, I didn't have a book under contract. And I had put together a few proposals for my editor, and we were kind of seeing just like what stuck. So I kind of came up with like a wish list of projects that I'd had in the back of my mind. And we ended up going with The Last Heir to Blackwood Library, and which was great. And I love my editor, but she actually ended up moving publishing houses. So I had a new editor. And when it came time to contract a new book, I said, I kind of fell in love with this idea the first time I pitched it. I'm just going to see what she thinks. And she ended up liking it. So we went from there. And as for how I came up with the idea to kind of move that location, like you said, to a new setting, I have just always loved Vanity Fair by William Makepeace Thackeray.
Oh, okay.
I love the book. I love any miniseries adaptation. That's kind of like my niche weird thing. Like, I will debate about the merits of different Vanity Fair adaptations. So I really love that, and I had always wanted to write a book set in that time period, that kind of has some elements of Vanity Fair in it. And also I had been wanting to write something like a very botanical or floral themed book, and it kind of felt like the aesthetic worked for that time period, like the kind of like that high regency in England, and all of that kind of lent itself to luscious flowers and language of flowers. So I mishmashed them together, and Book of Thorns is what was born.
Well, I know we're going
Okay.
to talk about art history background later, but what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me also with the context of that art history background that we share. Because, well, I don't know if it because is the right word, but I know that like I loved 19th century art. And though I'm well enough versed in like 20th centuries and such too, I really focused on the 19th century as much as I could, which this is. Because the art is so amazing and there's lots of floral still lives and there's so much meaning. It's really fascinating. So I wasn't sure also if, we were talking about Pinterest and inspiration. Was there any like paintings or anything that you were thinking about from that time?
One of
Oh, look at that.
my big floral tapestry behind me. I think with
Beautiful.
every book, I do love to do Pinterest, and I love like putting together mood boards and things. And so I definitely grab a lot of Regency portraiture, the women with the moody, cloudy skies behind them and the big upswept hair and holding a flower symbolizing something. So those always show up. A lot of the research I did was from Victorian books of flowers, like language floriography, which again is a little later than this time period. But the thing they all have in common is they're just all so gorgeously illustrated, and there's so much inspiration there. So I definitely took a lot of inspiration from, particularly, the author was Kate Greenaway, and she has a little volume with beautiful illustrations. Just very romantic and whimsical. So I really drew
I
in
love her
those.
work. I have some stuff that she did that was like kind of more children's illustration. She did also, but yeah, that's so cool. Well, another thing that you do really well in your books, aside from ghosts, we know you very well for your ghosts, but you also do sisters very well. And though these sisters spend most of the book apart, never really knowing each other, there is still a deep connection through this shared language of flowers. And this reminded me of one of your other books, which is The Orphan of Cemetery Hill, which also had sisters that spent a lot of that book apart. Can you speak to this character dynamic, which could be different books? If you wanted them to be, they could be different books, but their journeys are so entwined, regardless of whether or not they have different paths. So can you, how do you strike this balance?
First of all, I get like this little knot of panic in my chest when anybody mentions The Orphan of Cemetery Hill. Because I wrote that when I was like 9.5 months pregnant and then with a newborn. And honestly, I think I was in some sort of fugue state. I don't read so much of it. And I don't read my books again. So when you sent that question, I was like, oh, like I did read a book with sisters that were apart. I'm like, that is interesting. Like, that is a connection I hadn't made. But yeah, I definitely am drawn to sister dynamics or sibling dynamics in general, but because I write primarily for women, about women, it's usually sisters, with some exceptions. And they get, yeah, and like you said, they share that in the very literal sense in this book. They share a connection because they're sharing this kind of magical ability from their mother that they don't know. But it's also a really interesting, case study in nature versus nurture, because they're sisters, but they couldn't have had a more different life living on, different continents, if you will. And again, Cornelia living in essentially like very well, being well brought up, a gently bred lady, and Lisbeth being a servant. But still sharing those connections, not just that were passed down from their mother, but kind of the way they see the world and like the beauty they're striving for and what they want out of a world that in both cases is very limited at what it offers to women in both of their, and it kind of, it was an interesting contrast of, kind of the gilded cage of Cornelia, what her options were, which was like marriage essentially and not what she wanted, and Elizabeth, but like very literally like being a servant and not having many options at all. So So yeah, I think it was interesting to see those kind of stories and how they grew separately but kind of entwined until they meet.
I think I'm an only child, so maybe that's why I latched onto that too, because I'm so fascinated by the way you write siblings. Not having ever experienced, I mean, I have a lot of cousins that were around all the time, but it is still different.
So I did have a sister who passed away about 10 years ago, which I think is something probably that subconsciously comes out in my work a lot. Like, 'cause I do think about those sibling dynamics a lot. So especially with like Witch of Willow Hall, which I wrote in my sister's memory, I dedicated it to her. So I think that it's interesting for me to explore for different reasons. But yes, also I've heard that from other people, like, I'm an only child, or I always wished I had a sister. Like, you must have so many sisters. Like, is this what it's like, or something like that? But
Oh wow. I think that's really lovely, Hester. Thank you for sharing that with us. That actually is I now am reflecting on things differently, you know, as far as like reflecting on your work differently. There, you know, it's one of those things I was always fascinated with in the first place, just because I don't have that experience. But
right.
I think having a sibling and loss also, especially in the context of ghost stories, is a big deal, like when I'm looking back at your work. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for being receptive.
I do have to say, authors frequently tell me if they've been on the show more than one time that I do have a knack for like tapping into these weird things with their consistent things they didn't know were in their work.
It's so hard to see it for yourself, like when you're
Yeah.
in your own work, like, and I've said that before, you absolutely, oh, you do have a talent for like drawing out these threads and finding themes like that. So I'm
That's
not
our history
surprised
school. That's okay.
it
That's what we had to do, right?
did.
Compare and contrast these two paintings. It's 75% of your grade. That probably is where that comes from. But Diana Biller was like, coming on your show is like going to therapy.
Kind of is, yeah. It
Oh
kind
my
of is.
gosh. Oh my gosh. Well, speaking of that art history background, I know that, you know, you and I have talked about this before. So we both know how important flowers have been throughout centuries in art. And, you know, you were just talking about some cool historical images that you were looking at. But, you know, when we look at flowers through time and through art, you know, they could either be like a metaphorical still life, especially with women artists, which weren't really allowed to paint a lot of different things. They weren't allowed to sit in on life drawing classes and stuff, so they wound up doing a lot of flowers and still lifes. We also have alternative representations of ourselves, namely like with Georgia O'Keeffe using flowers to, you know, be a vagina. And, you know, then you have people like Robert Mapplethorpe, who did all kinds of crazy, crazy people pictures, but he loved to do flowers too because they were easier than people, or at least that's what he's quoted as saying. So all of these are examples of like the human relationship to flowers, which is also in your book. Were you thinking of this as a tradition when you wrote these things?
Yeah, absolutely. I think again because I did choose to nudge the timeline of my story earlier because I wanted to write in that time period of, you know, the Napoleonic Wars. But when we think of floriography in the language of flowers, we really are thinking of like high Victorian era, like 1850s, 60s, kind of up into the 1890s, early 1900s. And we know anything about Victorian society, we know that it was very constrictive to women. And flowers became this way to express very taboo, not even taboo subjects, things just kind of like were forbidden or, you know, women couldn't discuss easily. So the language of flowers became kind of this way, like, to me, it seems like to circumvent like a lot of, you know, social constrictions. So again, and I'm moving that a little bit earlier, even though there were floriography books and, you know, language of flower examples earlier than the Victorian era. That particular aspect of it really spoke to me, especially when, you know, viewing this story of these two sisters through the lens of the times they lived in. It's a way for her to express herself, you know, what she's feeling, what she's thinking, and it's perfectly socially acceptable. I mean, she's a servant, she's responsible for arranging flowers, so there's nothing wrong in that, but it is transgressive because this is it's her voice. And the same with Cornelia. Like, she's living under the thumb of her very strict, abusive uncle, kind of like a bird in a cage, again, with that analogy. And she paints flowers, and she writes this column in the Weekly Gazette or what have you, where she essentially is writing about the meaning of flowers. And so that becomes her kind of her voice too, her like way to express herself. And I love the flowers throughout art or throughout history. They've been such a powerful way for women to express themselves, because again, there's that connotation that they're feminine, and it's appropriate for women to be interested in flowers. Floral arranging is very genteel and elegant, and flowers are feminine and soft. And then kind of like taking it with like a little transgressive twist and making them like a really powerful vehicle for women's voices.
I love that you've called it transgressive because it absolutely was. When people go back and look at paintings and look at the history of the women artists that were painting at the time and producing this work, it absolutely was. I mean, Georgia O'Keeffe was also being transgressive in the 20th century with floral imagery, to the point where, it shocked people. Technically, she's just, portraying flowers, but there's so much going on.
Right.
And this is also true when you go back and look, like at the 19th century, so that people might go, oh, what a neat antique image of a paint, painting of a flower, set of flowers, but they're not really looking. And this is also true of fruit, which is another form of floral. Honestly, it's a botanical. When people paint fruit or vegetables or even meat, there's just so much going on that can be transgressive. And I love that there is a language of flowers because, as you're saying, the floriographies have always been really important. But the imagery is just. What they choose to show of the flower, even, is it the inside? Is it, dead flowers? Is it, all that kind of stuff is fascinating.
I like that you mentioned dead flowers, because a lot of the guys from the Victorian era, they make distinctions between like the different colors of flowers. So if you get a red rose, that means something different than if you get a yellow rose. If you get a dead rose, that means something different. So they were really using all the parts of flowers and different life stages and colors, different aspects of them.
It's coded. It's all coded language. It's fascinating. I've had a couple of people on in the last couple of months talking about that. And it is something that what I love about it is that as old as this tradition is, it's something that you can still put new, like people can still reinterpret things like using this old language and write about them differently. One's a mystery, one is, a nonfiction look at how fiction books have talked about these things. It's amazing. It's amazing. Gardens are also things that can be transgressive, like especially if it's like a poison garden or something. All kinds of crazy things. I love it so much. It's so fascinating. And I loved how the botanicals responded to the characters in this kind of magical way. It's one of those things where I felt, and this is going to sound crazy because it's in France, but I felt like as a Latina, I was like, that's something I know. And I related to it in my culture because that is the way one of the ways we think about it. It was just like this is a universal, like I guess, experience is thinking about them as far as like having a relationship to you directly.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that with me. I think, I mean, speaking as a white woman living on a occupied land as much as I can, that there's definitely like indigenous knowledge of plants and where you live and the flowers that you have access to. The deep meanings that they carry for different people are so powerful.
Well, like it's funny that I read this now too, because, here in Texas, and I'm in central Texas, so the hill country is alive right now with blue bonnets and other wildflowers. So you're driving down the freeway and it's like oceans of blue. And it's amazing because Texas has so few perks right now. But not wildflowers. Wildflowers are definitely a perk. But it is like my backyard has just got all these wildflowers everywhere. And it's just one of those things like we don't even plant them. They're just everywhere. And then, the blue kind of turns into purples and pinks and yellows. And it's just the spring is just awash in wildflowers right now, and it feels like magic. And I'm reading this book, and kind of like if I go to pick up my son or something, I'm like, it's lovely because this is happening right now. It's amazing. The timing of this book was perfect.
Well, I'm glad because I'm in Massachusetts and we're a few months behind you. We're just still getting, the first buds on the trees. I think it's supposed to snow tomorrow, so flowers have always been an escape in winter for me. New England winters, like going to museums and greenhouses that have flowers to kind of escape that
We'll
dreary
pay
New
for it
England
this
chill.
summer.
Yes.
Thinking about that when we're experiencing 118 degrees.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. I don't do heat either. I don't do cold, I don't do heat, so I don't know what I want.
Well, one of the other things that you did in this book that was really beautiful was that I really appreciated the different ways that you showed love. And I was just sort of making fun of myself for the video that I put out. It had lots and lots of love. Like that's the way I phrased it. But you did. And what I meant by that was that you had a lot of varieties of love, the way you portrayed it, whether it was love between friends, polyamorous relationships, you had pining, you had love between family, you had love for personal interests, like love for drawing was a very serious passion in here, to the point where it like her mental health would be affected if she wasn't able to express herself in this way. And that was true for the other, for Lisbeth also, who really needed to express herself through flowers. So it was a love for this thing too. It was such a prevalent theme, and it worked because you also had flawed characters. And I so rarely see characters that admit on page their own flaws with such honesty. I mean, they were just laying it out there, but they were also like standing by their need to be loved as they are, unafraid, especially for 19th century characters. That's really progressive. And this actually goes against a lot of story beats. A lot of times, as you know, we read a lot of historical romance, for example. You'll see that part of this is like kind of coming to terms with what they need, whereas these characters that you've written know from the beginning what they need. Did you know you wanted to write it this way, or is this just something that happened as you were writing about Sisters of Flowers?
Yeah, I think once I got to know the characters and started writing their stories, this is just kind of how it unfolded. I think also having like the dual point of views, the two different characters gave me a lot more room to explore those different relationships. Like a lot of times when it's a story with a love interest and a main character, like you're kind of trying to get from point A to point B, where they're in love with each other. And if you can, I love friendship relationships too, like. If you can work that in, that's great. But there's not a lot of space to explore these different kinds of relationships. So this definitely gave me the space to do that with two different characters. And again, there's that fantasy. I mean, it's a historical fantasy. There's not a huge element of magic in it, but it's there. I think just having that door cracked open a little in that genre also allows me, like you said, like it again, we don't hear all the stories from certain time periods, like stories are erased, voices are erased, so we don't really know. But yes, it would, probably be very unusual for some of these relationships to have happened historically. We don't know, but again, having that fantasy element there kind of gave me a lot of freedom to give the characters what they deserved, and I really wanted them to. I want to show that they were worthy of the love that they wanted. So for the time period, it might have been a little bit exceptional, like Cordelia is very independent and she knows what she wants. And again, going back to my Vanity Fair obsession, like Becky Sharp, love, hate her, whatever, but like she knows what she wants. And so I definitely wanted to give Cornelia some of that. Cornelia definitely, goes after what she wants, and also she knew what she wanted when she met these people that she fell in love with. And I wanted her, and it was more than just kind of like, I don't know, the why choose trope. Like it was definitely that this is somebody whose the way she loved was would have been viewed differently in that time period, but she absolutely deserved to love the people that she loved and be loved in return. So yeah, I love that you picked out that theme, and I love that you were love, love, love.
Love,
We need more of it, and my books are meant to be escapes.
Well, what I love about this is that I think those things certainly existed. There's no question that
This is just how people are, but it
Right.
was a matter of what was allowed and what wasn't. And part of me wondered also, like, did she feel a certain level of freedom because she was no longer in England? She was in France now, you know, and culturally it's different. And they're on a battlefield, like, or, you know, in a battle encampment. All bets are off, you know, or
Yeah,
you
no,
might
I'm
die
glad you.
tomorrow.
Right, and I'm glad you brought that up because one of the really interesting parts about researching this book was researching camp life and of soldiers and in France and Napoleon's army in particular. And I guess I had just never really given it a lot of thought before. And I put this in the afterword or the author's note of my book that when I started writing this book, I was like, oh crap, I have to write about like military stuff, like I have to write about the movement of armies and weaponry. And like, this is all very Bernard Cornwell. And like, he does that well. I have no idea what I'm doing. But what I learned was that I was very prejudiced in my own, the way I have been thinking of the history. I was like, this is men's stuff. Like, I'm not good at it. I don't understand. I don't like war. I don't understand military movement and things like that. But the truth was so much more varied and diverse than what I had thought of. That women were very much a part of camp life and soldier life. There were women who fought, and they were called, and I don't speak French, so please, God, anybody listening, forgive me. Vivandières, I believe they were called Vivandières, which were women, and they dressed as women. They were women. They weren't, you know, they weren't hiding their
Disguise.
sex or yes, or dressing as men. But they essentially ran a lot of the life in the camps. They sold things. You had to have like a commission to be able to sell directly to soldiers. There was like a law around it. So they set up like little commissaries essentially in camps, and they were selling goods and like providing drinks and kind of like you know, a social life in the camp. And then when it was time to fight, they were actually going out onto the front lines to bring refreshments is the wrong word, to bring like water and food to soldiers on the front lines. They were, and some of them would go in with rifles and would also fight. And I had never thought of that. And again, just a lot of soldiers brought their wives with them, their families. So there are these big trains of people like moving across the landscape and camping and setting up these like little liminal spaces, communities.
That's fascinating.
It was really interesting. So yeah, so in terms of Cornelia's story and, you know, her relationships, it was vastly different from anything she had experienced with, you know, like the drawing room etiquette and dances and things like that. To that degree of freedom, and not just being in France in a different kind of culture, but also being this very specific culture in this specific moment of time when there is like, you know, post French Revolution, there's women had a lot more freedoms than they had just been, you know, won during the revolution. And then to be in this kind of like mixed company, this sanctioned mixed company of the army. So I think it did lend itself as being a good vehicle for her to be able to explore that kind of relationship.
Yeah, even as a guarded person, like she had a guard with her 100% of the time ish, she still had more freedom. It was
Yes.
Hester. I know that you and I have texted about this already because I had questions, but I asked you if there were intentional Pride and Prejudice Easter eggs. because I saw things that reminded me of Pride and Prejudice specifically, not at Jane Austen's other novels, but specifically that novel. But she was also writing during the Napoleonic Wars, so it actually just makes sense that there would be things that happen again. But there was some, you know, okay, so the soldiers, like, you know, I just hear in my head, like, you know, officers have come to Meryton, you know. And they wanted to them invited to the ball, and there was officers all over this and soldiers all
Yeah,
over this
if we know
novel.
one thing from Pride and Prejudice, women go weak in the knees at the sight of a red coat.
Isn't it true? Isn't it true? And then like the five daughters that like all go to the window to look at the Brits who've like occupied the house across the street. And what was funny to me is I think it's the second oldest daughter in that one doesn't rush to the window in the same way and just sort of looks at Lisbeth with a wink. And I was like, that's Elizabeth Bennet. And the others are the rest of the
It's
girls.
so funny because, yeah, I mean, I think it was probably subconsciously because, again, like we're all reading Austen, we're all obsessed. So she's definitely like part of my subconscious when I'm writing. I also read a really interesting book for research, and I want to say is by Lucy Worsley. I remember the title, but it's essentially like a biography of Jane Austen, but through the lens of the time and what she was living in. So I talked a lot about, like the wars and kind of the references to that that we might miss in her books because we don't think of her writing about wars, but they very much informed the society that she was living in. So yeah, so I think whether subconsciously or not, there's definitely a lot of her influence in there. And it's funny you brought up that scene with the window because I think I responded to you saying like I love like Regency busybody ladies or Victorian busybodies.
Yes.
And there's the Cranford miniseries with Dame Judi Dench, which I love. There's like a still of that. I was trying to find the image to send to you because there's like all the little old ladies in Cranford, their little lace caps all peering out the window to get a glimpse of like the drama. And I'm like, that is just like what I aspire to. So I love,
I love it.
again, like we can go deeper with that. Like I love, because women in the domestic sphere, kind of with a limited view of what's going on, looking out the windows and the gossip network and everything like that. Like I just love it.
That's so funny. Well, then once I saw one, I started looking for him. Even if they weren't there, I was like, I'm gonna look for these. I was like, is this Mr. Wickham? I was Armand, I think is his name. Like, I was like, I think is he Mr. Wickham? Of course, his arc is different, but it was just kind of funny. Like I was really looking. I was once I found one, I was, of course, if you want to find them, you'll find them. You know what I mean? So I was like, I'm gonna ask her. But that was such a good time. And I do think fans of Austen will like your novel for a lot of these fun other things as well, but definitely for things that give you the feeling that those things in Pride and Prejudice also give you. So hey fans of Pride and Prejudice, you'll definitely like this one. So for anybody listening that wants to know like some of the things that I highlighted, I have one passage here for people, which is him. Let me see. Let me. Okay, it's Lisbeth. It's from Lisbeth's point of view. Lisbeth does not speak, but she definitely has internal dialogue. So she says, I almost wish that he had never looked me in the eye or touched my hand so gently, because then I would not know what it is to long for something that I can never have. Okay, y'all, brace yourself. I tasted just a little sweetness, and now I know only hunger. Hester Fox. Oh my God, that's so good. I
Thank
was
you.
sending pictures of that passage to people because it's so good. And the book is full of these. I did this several times and sent several pictures because it's so good.
Makes me so happy. Thank you so
Oh,
much.
I'm swooning. I was swooning so much throughout this book. And I just know that, even if it's not gothic, like your gothic fans will love it, but you're also going to get new fans of like that just love historical fiction or even romantic things. I wouldn't say romance because you're not trying to hit the romance beats, but it's just such a wonderful book, so beautifully told. Congratulations on this.
Thank you so much. That means a lot. This was the first book I wrote in a long time that wasn't written between, crying infants or breastfeeding. And it's just, I feel like I was able to put a lot more of myself into it because I had a lot more to give. So I'm really glad that that came through.
Oh, that's so nice. Are you allowed to tell us what's next?
Yeah, of course. And I was kind of like, when we were talking about the art history angle things, I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to talk about what's next.
I'm
Because
so excited.
so my next book is something I started years ago as just kind of like a side project. And again, it was like, let's see what my editor thinks. Like this might be the time to pitch this. And it actually was. So I'm so excited because this is a book that's really close to my heart. The working title is, what is the working title? Petal White, Water Dark. I think is probably going to change, but we'll see.
Love it so much already, though. Oh my gosh.
So if I had to give like a log line, it's a gender flipped Little Mermaid set in the waning days of the Dutch Golden Age,
Oh.
drawing on the folklore of Friesland, where my mother's side of the family is from. It is a little bit of an allegory for climate change. It is a little bit or a lot fantasy, magic, romance. There's darkness. You know that I'm going to get my gothic tropes in there somehow, so they're
I love
there.
it. I love
And
it.
of course, how can you write about like Dutch Golden Age without writing about the art? So art does play a very big part of it, and I'm so excited for it.
Y'all cannot see my face. I am just like, oh my gosh, I'm so excited. I'm squealing. That is so my jam. I feel again, I ask you this literally every book. How is it that you write books that are just for me? And I don't know how you do that every time, but you do.
I think every author should be as lucky to have a reader like you, because I so appreciate that, like you get it. But yeah, I'm so happy that this sounds like something you're gonna enjoy.
Yes, I'm already. I see, I have like the corner of my mouth here. I'm already salivating for it. Oh my gosh. Well, again, I'm so happy that you were able to come on the show and talk about the Book of Thorns. Thank you so much for your time. I can't, and everybody get your pre-orders in because this book comes out April 2nd.
And if I can, I'll if people want to email me like proof of purchase of their pre-order, I have a raffle for a prize pack, and it's going to have include like a Victorian well a reprint a Victorian reprint of a book of flowers, some little floral goodies, and like of course stickers and things like that. So I'm going
Fun.
to do a drawing.
Okay, well, we'll have links to, like, I'll put your email for that in the show notes as well.
Okay, thank
All
you.
right, well, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me today on She Wore Black. If you like what you heard and want to support my work on the show, you can visit my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com for links to my Patreon, my coffee donation site, as well as my merch and my online bookshop. You can also help out the show by rating me on Apple and following me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and letting your friends know about the show. Thanks for joining me today, and happy reading.